Hello, I'm John Guernsey. This is number 0245, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0245. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mark Langan, who is a former undercover police officer and the author of Busting Bad Guys.
A lot of times I went undercover in investigations and the drug dealers would give me large amounts of drugs and assume that I was going out on the street and selling the drugs. Well, police officers, that's where we draw the line. You know, our job's not to sell drugs on the street. So it's all a mind game. It's a battle of wits is what I'd always say. It's a game between us and the drug dealer. Fascinating area of police work.
Dr. James Hubbard, the survival doctor, is back to talk about medical myths and mistakes in movies and TV.
The one that seems to be more obvious to me lately is chest compressions. I'm not blaming the people that are doing that because this is a real actor down there that supposedly has no pulse and no signs of life. And so you're not going to do chest compressions deep because a live actor wouldn't tolerate that. In real life, you should know how to do chest compressions. But remember that it's mid-chest and that you compress the chest about 2 inches. You get in there pretty deep, and on television, they just barely touch. And of course, they're just acting.
We have a retro interview with the late comic David Brenner, who just kind of fell into comedy.
Yeah, I started as a writer, producer, director of documentaries, and was the head of the documentary department for two networks down here. I was just doing that in the interim. I actually started out trying to either write screenplays or get a radio show. And I didn't do either one, and I fell into this job with television. And then when I left that, in the interim period of figuring out what to do with my life, I started doing stand-up comedy just as a joke. But it's a very long joke. I mean, this joke has been running a long time. My careers have all been flukes.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, plus, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0245, was John Guernsey, who was a security guard at Montreal's Dominion Square building. Thank you very much, John, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 27-year-old British artist Millie Brown, profiled in January in London's Daily Mail, creates Jackson Pollock-like canvases by vomiting on them after ingesting colored soy milk. Brown, whose work hangs in London's Ripley's Believe It or Not showcase, said she fasts for 2 days prior to public performances and, as the show starts, times her ingestion so that the proper hues don't prematurely mix in her stomach. Her appearance at work in a Lady Gaga music video brought her a somewhat larger audience, said the understated Brown. I am able to challenge people's perceptions of beauty. Yeah. I'll bet a lot of people are thinking she can't possibly take this any further. Oh, I think she can. I shudder to think what kind of art can spew from other orifices of Ms. Brown's. In any case, we're not done with artists just yet. Paris's Hunting and Wildlife Museum hosted from April 1st to the 13th artist Abraham Poincheval's real-time demonstration of birth and rebirth. It was a situation in which he was living completely inside a hollowed-out bear carcass the entire time, eating, drinking, reading, sleeping, and relieving himself. He was relieving himself down the bear's leg, in case you're wondering. All this before a live camera with a viewing window for spectators. Abraham, who in a previous installation lived for a while in a hole, likened the experience merely to the cramped quarters of astronauts. Wow. Somebody really misses the womb, I'm guessing. And we've got a couple of stories dealing with petty thefts. Actually, just one. Actually, two. stories dealing with petty thefts. First story, although 29-year-old Douglas Lydick escaped from a patrol car in December in Commodore, Pennsylvania, while handcuffed and was soon recaptured, I may add, prosecutors declined to charge him with fleeing since he was merely being detained at the time. However, they did charge him with theft of the handcuffs. Oh, that's good. That's really good. Meanwhile, Dustin Bell, age 25, who was wearing a police officer's badge that had been stolen from the Sand Springs, Oklahoma department, apparently only casually considered how to wield his newly acquired authority. He was arrested in April after asking a Tulsa tanning salon for a law enforcement discount to get a $34 session for $10. Well, he's going to miss the idea of tanning now because you know where he's going? He won't be seeing the sun for a while. Elsewhere, four Maine State Police troopers rushed to a home in the town of China in January, alarmed by 911 calls about an assault in progress, according to neighbors who reported ruckus screaming. Trooper Thomas Bureau found that the suspected crime scene was the home of a pig farmer who showed troopers the pen out back in which a male had been placed with five sows in heat, and that the squealing, either by the sows or the beleaguered male, was not unusual. Yep, they were just making bacon. And we have two stories that sound like something out of a bad porn movie dreamt up by a teenage boy. Number one, Ms. Terry Boyd, age 52, was ordered on probation in Warsaw, Wisconsin, in February on charges of imprisoning two men in a second-story bedroom, leaving them screaming for help from the window. According to police, Boyd had refused to release the men until at least one agreed to have sex with her. I'm wondering what she used to lure them. I'm guessing ESPN. And by the way, I've seen her mugshot. She does have that Kathy Bates look from Misery going for her. And story number two, Maria Montañez Colon, a 58-year-old widow, called 911 in February in Punta Gorda, Florida, after responding officers reported that she immediately began fondling them, describing herself as horny, noting, "I haven't been penetrated in years." Ooh. The officer politely declined and warned her about frivolous 911 calls, but Maria was arrested shortly afterward when she called again, asking the second responding officer, "How else am I going to have sex?" Okay, again, I've seen her mugshot too. It's not like she's hideous or anything, far from it. Perhaps she should have tried a local bar rather than using 911. Her needs might have been met. Just stay off Craigslist. That's all I ask you to do, Maria. Stay off Craigslist. And we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 24-year-old Brian Hill was arrested in Indianapolis in March, passed out in the driver's seat of his car at 4 a.m., wearing only a T-shirt, underwear, and one sock. The officer said Hill did have pants on, but they were on his arms. Both arms were inserted into the legs of his jeans. Okay, you have to be really drunk to be in this situation, but what I really want to know is, where's the other sock? Yeah. Anyway, time for our first guest here on the Stuff File program. Before retiring after 26 years with the Omaha Police Department, Mark Langan had busted his share of bookies, drug dealers, and ladies of the night. Mark is the author of Busting Bad Guys, and he joins us on the line from Nebraska. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, it's very exciting. I really appreciate this opportunity.
I've had the opportunity in the past to talk to people who have done some undercover work in the past, and I'm just wondering, is there ever a concern, an issue with being a cop in those situations?
It really is a concern, and I write about those concerns in the book. I write about a drug deal that I was undercover in, buying a large amount of cocaine, and the drug dealer was kind of back in a back garage bay of a business. And he put a line of cocaine out in front of me, and he said, "Go ahead and try it." Well, obviously, undercover police officers don't want to try the cocaine. And so I had to think quick on my feet, came up with an excuse, and he bought it. Luckily, but very dangerous situation that I was put in, and undercover officers across the country are put in those situations where, you know, the dealers want the cops to try the drugs, and that's just something cops aren't going to do.
What kind of excuse would work in a situation like that? What did you tell him?
You know what I told him was, and it's a good excuse, I said, you know, I've got to go to work in a couple hours, and if I snort this cocaine, I'm going to get a nosebleed because my sinus cavities are so screwed up from all my cocaine use. And right away he looks at me and he goes, oh, I have the same problem, and I understand. And you know, thank God he bought the excuse. But, you know, undercover officers have to be very quick on their feet because you never know the situation they're going to be put in. And female undercover officers, and I write about this, have advantages and disadvantages on buying drugs. The advantages are the drug dealers are the defenses are not up like they are with a guy. But the disadvantage is most drug dealers want to have sex with the female officers because that's just kind of how it works in the drug world. Sex, drugs, rock and roll. A lot of girls trade sexual favors for drugs. So we really had to be careful the situations we put the female officers in.
How close can one get to the line when it comes to being an undercover officer and breaking the law?
That's a very difficult question to answer because, you know, obviously it's against the law for police officers to use narcotics. Police officers do not want to use narcotics. Now, it's legal for police officers to buy drugs from an undercover, or I'm sorry, from a drug dealer in an undercover capacity because that's how the game's played. Our job is to try to make drug buys from them and then arrest them for selling drugs. A lot of times I went undercover in investigations and the drug dealers would give me large amounts of drugs and assume that I was going out on the street and selling the drugs. Well, police officers, that's where we draw the line. You know, our job is not to sell drugs on the street. So it's all a mind game. It's a battle of wits is what I'd always say. It's a game between us and the drug dealer. Fascinating area of police work.
When you go into undercover police work, what does the police department ask of you? And the reason why I bring that up is, do they find police officers who are single, for instance? I mean, sometimes I would assume that there's a difficulty if you've got a wife and kids and you're going undercover. There's a lot playing on one's mind when you're in that situation, I'm sure.
You know, not necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of married undercover officers, single undercover officers. It's just you have to find a strong-willed officer that can handle the stress of being undercover and not give in to the temptations of the drug dealer's life. You know, I'll be honest with you, and I write about this in Busting Bad Guys. There are some aspects of a drug dealer's life that are fascinating and appealing. You know, the allure of big money, the allure of women at your beck and call because they love the drug dealers in a lot of situations. So you have to find the strong-willed police officer that can draw the line and realize, hey, I am not going to cross that line over to the dark side.
Now, we touched on the fact that you worked undercover in drugs. You also worked undercover in vice. So I'll ask a similar question to the drugs question. And again, is how far can one go when it comes to working undercover in vice?
Well, you talk about temptations. they multiply 10 times when you start working prostitution operations, escort investigations. We really have to have strong-willed police officers that can handle those situations. Our job as undercover officers was to meet with the girls, proposition them for a sex act, get them to agree to it, and then arrest them. You know, but there's a lot of temptations involved in those scenarios. Therein lies, again, the temptations for the officers to cross the line. And, you know, historically across the country, police officers have gotten in trouble on prostitution operations because they just can't. They can't get over that temptation, and there have been cops fired around the country for giving into those temptations.
While I know that prostitution is definitely not a victimless crime, it's not the same as drugs, and by that I mean, do you ever feel guilty or compassion in you know, arresting a hooker, for instance, especially if you hear her so-called backstory as to why she's doing what she's doing and how she got into what she's been into?
Well, I wasn't unsympathetic to the girls' plights on the streets, don't get me wrong. In fact, a career Omaha, Nebraska prostitute on the street for 30 years, our careers kind of paralleled, in fact, writes a chapter in my book, Busting Bad Guys, about her life on the streets. Fascinating chapter. Did I feel sorry for a lot of them? You bet. Is it a victimless crime? Absolutely not. And most of the prostitution investigations we did involved drug use and or drug sales, involved robberies, the Johns being rolled and robbed, girls being beat up by their pimps. So the crime of prostitution involves many, many other violent crimes, which is why I'm asked frequently, should it be legalized? And I say absolutely not because of the vast number of other crimes associated with prostitution.
You've written this book now. The book, again, is called Busting Bad Guys, True Crime Stories of Bookies, Drug Dealers, and Ladies of the Night. who do you see your primary audience for writing this book was?
You know, when I was writing the book, I thought my primary audience would be cops. I'm actually finding out my big audience are the true crime lovers, people that love to read true crime stories about drug dealing, homicides, serial killers, whatever it might be. There's cops writing books on all kinds of topics. My book touches on the very personal aspect of how much I loved my job, the stresses involved with my job. I was involved in an officer-involved shooting after I'd been on the job for 24 years, and I write in depth the impact it had on myself, the other officers involved, the victim's family that was shot and killed. Fascinating chapter at the end of the book of me meeting with a family member of the person that we shot and killed years after the shooting, kind of a closure-type session. So I think anybody who loves true crime stories will really like Busting Bad Guys, and we're getting great play across the country now in Canada in regards to this book. I'm really surprised as to how it's taken off.
Do you concern yourself, or were you worried when you were writing the book that you were either giving a primer to some criminals as to how to commit crime, or worse, a primer to some criminals as how to spot somebody who is working undercover?
Yes, I was very, very nervous and worried about that, and I stayed very high level in the book on undercover investigations. I didn't get into the weeds in regards to the specific do's and don'ts for police officers, the type of equipment that's used, because I have a huge allegiance to police officers worldwide, obviously, and I'm not going to give away trade secrets, but there's just enough in the book that's going to pique a lot of people's interest in regards to what goes into an undercover narcotics operation, the dangers, the stresses, the stress on the family members of the cops. I mean, I enjoyed writing this book, and people that read it say they find it fascinating.
Do you ever, or did you ever concern yourself with the idea, the concept that, you know, in your own private life, in your own day-to-day living, you might come across somebody on the street who you worked on the opposite side of undercover-wise?
Happens all the time. You know, Omaha's a town of 400,000 people, so it's a, you know, relatively good-sized town, but I see people all the time that I previously arrested, and I've never had a bad experience, especially with the book coming out. It's amazing, Peter, that people will come up to me and say, hey, am I in the book? And they want to be in the book, people that I previously arrested. It's just fascinating, and I've had people send me pictures of themselves to put on the Facebook page, people that I previously arrested. So, you know, I always treated people with respect that myself and my crew arrested. We never threw any bogus charges on people, or we treated them pretty well. And I think that now that's why people come up to me and they'll say, do you recognize me from 20 years ago? You arrested me, and my life's great now. I'm clean. I've got a family. But that happens to me all the time here in Omaha, Nebraska.
The book is called Busting Bad Guys. People can check out your website, which is bustingbadguys.com. Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Mark Langan, author of Busting Bad Guys. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0245, and you'll find links to both Mark's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about first aid on TV. It's not as real as it looks. Plus, we have a retro interview with someone no longer with us, the late comedian David Brenner. And of course, there is an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, in April, Louisiana state senators rejected Senator Elbert Gilroy's over-the-top campaigning to make chicken boxing legitimate, dismissing his proposed bill and leaving the sport banned along with cockfighting. The proposed law would still have permitted sharp spurs on fighting roosters' legs, but required promoters to cover them with rubber gloves. Gilroy had pleaded with colleagues there would be no blood, no knives, no cruelty, no abuse, as he held up a pair of the tiny chicken boxing gloves in an act of utter futility. Oh my God. You know, the only thing missing from this story is a banjo soundtrack. Speaking of which, a bill stalled in the North Carolina State Senate after Republicans forced an amendment. The bill was to make the Columbian mammoth the official state fossil. The amendment inserted language to give God credit for the fossil. The bill had passed the House 2 months before without such language. Said Senator Kevin Bryant about his amendment, "I think it's appropriate time to acknowledge the Creator." When his addition of a biblical verse was ruled out of order, Senator Mike Fair filed an objection, effectively killing the bill, which was sponsored by a House Democrat. Senate Majority Leader Harvey Peeler said the Senate got a lot of unfriendly email over the matter. For example, "Please stop making our state look like backwards hillbillies who believe in fairy tales. Keep your religious views out of the government." Fair was informed that an 8-year-old schoolgirl was behind the bill, so he withdrew his objection, and it passed 35-0. You know, I thought North Carolina state senators were already widely acknowledged as the official state fossil. Moving right along, the San Mateo County, California District Attorney's Office says a 37-year-old by the name of Monica Marie Jenkins was drunk at San Francisco International Airport. So drunk that she refused suggestions to take a later flight and instead demanded to be taken to jail. Airport police officers obliged. Once handcuffed in the back of the police car, officers say Jenkins demanded that they, quote, "give me some cocaine," unquote, and sang the theme song to the 1974 TV hit series Happy Days. By the way, she sang it very badly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock rock went her lyrics. Yeah. Prosecutors said that she also kicked an officer and tried to bite a nurse at the jail. Jenkins knows her way around jails, by the way. She is a Los Angeles County public defender. Well, at least she probably knows a good lawyer. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's a type of story that never gets old. Women who hide items in their lady bits. Yes, police in Tennessee say 19-year-old Dallas Archer smuggled a gun into jail after she was arrested on a charge of driving on a suspended license. The report says a North American Arms 22 caliber mini revolver was discovered after a body cavity search, and I'll give you one guess which cavity that pistol was discovered in. What's more, the revolver was loaded. A computer check later revealed that the weapon, which is 4 inches in length, I'm starting to like this girl, had been stolen from an auto burglary in 2013. The pistol's owner was identified and told what had happened. He commented that he would eventually like the little fellow returned, but added that the weapon would require a bath in bleach. which, by the way, is not the proper way to clean a gun, in case you're wondering. Archer was charged with possession of stolen property, illegal possession of a firearm, and introducing contraband into the jail. You know, she certainly brings new meaning to the term pistol-packing mama, doesn't she? Yes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Dr. James Hubbard, the survival doctor, is back on the program. He's the author of Living Ready Pocket Manual First Aid. And this time around, Dr. James is here to talk about what disaster movies and TV shows get wrong when it comes to survival skills. James is on the line from Colorado. Hi, James.
Hi.
Thanks for being back on the program with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to do it.
When I saw the little blurb about talking about this issue, it was right in my wheelhouse. I grew up in the 60s watching television shows like Mannix. And every second week on Mannix, he got hit over the back of the head with a gun butt. And I figured he should have been a vegetable after 7 years.
That's true. That happens a lot, doesn't it? And it just depends on what I have found that the only way I have peace with these types of things and being a doctor is to think, okay, they're just making this dramatic. They don't care about the actual real medical facts about this. And I think viewers should too. Don't ever use television programs like that to base your ways of doing medicine.
So what types of things do you see in movies that are, for you, the most glaring?
Well, that's one of them, but let me the one that seems to be more obvious to me lately is chest compressions. Now, again, I'm not blaming the people that are doing that, because this is a real actor down there that supposedly has no pulse and no signs of life. And so you're not going to do chest compressions deep, but so they don't do them very deep at all, because a live actor wouldn't tolerate that. In real life, you should know how to do chest compressions either by taking a course, which is your best way, but remember that it's mid-chest and that you compress the chest about 2 inches, which is pretty deep, which is a lot of times about a third of the chest depth. So you get in there pretty deep, and on television they just barely touch, and of course they're just acting, and that's one of the things among many.
Yeah, I've never heard of actors having their ribs broken when they were playing.
I don't think they'd tolerate that very well.
Exactly.
Getting the heart massaged, you know.
So that one I kind of understand because of the explanation you just gave. But what about just things that are plain wrong? For instance, not applying pressure to a gunshot wound.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my pet peeves, too. And finally, I saw in one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's movie back a few years ago, somebody got shot, and he said, and they said, what should I do? And he said, put pressure on it. And that's what you should do. I mean, if you have a gunshot wound or any type of bleeding, the first thing you should do is apply direct pressure with your hand or with a cloth or something like that. But push pressure on it, and 90% of the time, that'll stop the bleeding.
Okay. And I also understand that Mel Gibson had it wrong. You can't fix a dislocated shoulder by slamming it into a wall?
You know, I've heard of people that tell me that they've done that. I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea. The shoulder joint is a little ball in a shallow cup, and when it comes out of joint, the muscles all are tense and everything, but that ball gets out of that cup and gets to the side of the rim so that it just can't get back in. And in my mind, and I think in most doctors' mind, doing something like that, it would be the only way you get it back is to break that little cup and put it back in the rim. What you do is you try to relax those muscles in some way or the other, or you try to manipulate the shoulder joint so that it goes back in. There's a way that you can move it around, but you never force it and you never beat on somebody.
I would assume, being a doctor, that the thing that would annoy you the most in televisions and movie shows is when somebody does something as a character, and that character is a medical profession. professional rather.
Yeah, that's true, and certainly that happens a lot. And I actually saw somebody back several years ago that supposedly a doctor that was looking in. I think it was an ear. It was a scope you used to look in an ear, and he had it backwards. He turned it backwards when he was looking in there. So again, that this is all show, and I try not to get too concerned. I really don't watch the real life medical dramas just because they're a little. You know, I get enough of that drama in real life, and also, like you said, a lot of times. It's just not really how you would actually do it in real life.
Okay, most of these shows and movies, though, do have a technical advisor on staff who's usually in the medical profession. Perhaps maybe what your job should be is training some of the technical producers.
You know, they probably do have that, but then those people say, okay, well, we're not going to take 15 minutes to do adequate chest compressions on this person. We've got to do it really quick and easy, and so they have to compromise. One of the things that bothers me is you have a, and I think it bothers me because people might get the wrong idea. Someone gets shot their whole idea or their whole focus is trying to get that bullet out. Well, you got to get that bullet out, and as soon as they get the bullet out, the person kind of revives and gets back to normal. I saw one where somebody got shot in the chest. They said, well, that bullet, I'm okay because the bullet went all the way through. In other words, the bullet's gone, so I'm okay. Well, it's not the bullet that causes problems. That's the least of your worries when you get shot, at least initially. It's the damage that the bullet did when it was when it enters you. You know, it could puncture a lung, it could have a burst of or damage a blood vessel, and if it damages a blood vessel, you're not going to know it, and you know it. Don't get that bullet out. That's going to not make any difference in the damage that's already done. I tried to take a bullet out one time. In fact, I did, and it took me forever. It just depends. I mean, if you could feel it, you could take it out. Otherwise, you're just going to go deeper and deeper and cause more problems probably than you help. And certainly that's not the first aid or the first things you should think about saving a life.
Yet we all watch television and movies, and we seem to know the technology. You just described it through and through, right?
Yeah. I mean, if it goes through a muscle, okay. But really and truly, if the bullet stays in the muscle, same, you know, it's not going to make any difference one way or the other, at least initially. I mean, a lot of people that are in war have had fragments and metal fragments in them all their lives, and they do fine. The only thing the bullet might do is cause some infection, the bullet itself. But again, if you're trying to really dig around and try to get it out, you're probably going to be more likely to cause more infection than you help.
Well, speaking of gunshots, one of the things that people always seem to, or writers, I should say, always seem to put into stories if they want to just merely injure their hero, it seems that the least dangerous spot to get a bullet is the shoulder. And I'm assuming that's not correct.
Oh, it's not true. Now, if it went through the muscle and didn't hit the bone and went through the outer part of the shoulder, fine. But that's one of the things I learned in anatomy class initially. They cringe because, you know, if you get in the inside that shoulder joint, there's lung, there are large, important blood vessels, there are large, important nerves, and so there's a lot of stuff in there that could potentially be damaged. So just because you get a shoulder injury, and a lot of times if it's the upper chest type shoulder injury, then, you know, there's so many things that could be damaged in that till it, you know, you could be okay. You can be okay with anything, I guess, but chances are that at least most of the time or some of the time, there's going to be some major damage.
Since we're talking about the ways that people are dealing with injuries that are, you know, sometimes self-inflicted, sometimes out in the field, sometimes away from hospitals, perhaps what these television researchers and technicians should do is perhaps get a copy of your book, which is Living Ready Pocket Manual First Aid, and they could learn what to do and what not to do when they're writing these scripts.
Hey, that's a great idea.
And
you can find that at Sam's. You can find it at on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and at my website, thesurvivaldoctor.com.
Dr. James, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you.
Dr. James Hubbard. Again, his book is Living Ready Pocket Manual First Aid. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0245, and you'll find links to both James's website and also links to where you can sign up for his newsletter, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A soup kitchen in Florida called Love Thy Neighbor has provided meals for the homeless for more than 20 years. Then one day it was sued by a business that makes jewelry called Love Your Neighbor. That's right, Love Your Neighbor was suing Love Thy Neighbor. Unbelievable, but the business wanted a website name that had been purchased years earlier by the charity, and it was willing to sue for it. I'm telling you this story because it gives us a chance to show how the effort to raise awareness about the lawsuit problem in America really can make a difference. After we heard about the lawsuit, we brought it to the attention of a major newspaper. The paper then made it a front-page story. All of the media attention helped the charity find a lawyer who donated much of his time and finally got the lawsuit dismissed. Let's be fair, not all victims of lawsuits are so fortunate. However, it shows what can happen when we choose to say enough is enough. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses. But recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity who is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in June of 1994, and it's with someone who left us just recently. This was a man who was a stand-up comedian, actor, and author. He was also the most frequent guest on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson in the 70s and 80s. I'm talking about David Brenner. At the time we spoke to him, he was about to add another accolade on his resume. He was about to replace Larry King on his nightly radio show, so it was a chance to talk to David about his transition into radio and his career. We spoke to him from Branson, Missouri, where he was doing his stage act. Here is part of that conversation now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your comedy. You say you work clean. Is that an indictment against those who don't, or is just your personal style?
No, I work tall, and I have nothing against short comedians. No, not at all. I mean, I'm the last one to be a prude. I come from the slums of a big city of Philadelphia. I mean, no. I just find it more challenging. Two reasons. One, I find it more challenging to get laughs with clean material. And the classic, the great American comedians, and of course, British like Charlie Chaplin. I mean, the great comedians all work clean. W.C. Fields, Jack Benny, George Burns, Milton Berle, Annie Youngman, and they were great superstars. They all work clean. And secondly, I just think that the job of an entertainer is to entertain. And if you get anybody uptight, then you're not doing your job. And then thirdly, I'm always getting ready for TV, and what are you going to do with all that dirty material? So I like the challenge. I think it's more of a challenge than that. I think it's probably just my ego saying, come on, get out there and kill an audience of drunken gamblers with clean material. That's really accomplishing something.
Your career has taken various turns. You didn't start out in comedy, did you not? You started out as a producer?
Yeah, I started out as a writer, producer, director of documentaries, and was the head of the documentary department for two networks down here. And I was just doing that in the interim. I actually started out trying to either write screenplays or get a radio show. And I didn't do either one, and I fell into this job in television. And then when I left that, in the interim period of figuring out what to do with my life, I started doing stand-up comedy just as a joke. But it's a very long joke. I mean, this joke has been going on a long time. So it was just, my careers have all been flukes.
So it sounds like you're where you want to be, or where you wanted to be originally. You said you wanted to have a radio program. Now you do.
And that's what I wanted to do. I majored in mass communications at college and was leaning towards radio. I just found it so fascinating. And just fell into TV and then fell into live and comedy and writing books and all that. But I never got a chance to do the radio show, except if I took over for somebody when they were sick or went on vacation. So this is a great, not only an opportunity, but it's a fulfillment of an area that I really thought was going to pass me by.
you spent a lot of time doing comedy, and therefore in the public eye, you've been interviewed several times. How does that help you as an interviewer?
Well, I think I think I would pull more of my experience for interviewing from my experience as my background as a journalist in television when I was doing documentaries, and from hosting all the TV shows that I have in the States. You know, I hosted the Tonight Show for years, and also filled in for other TV talk show hosts here in the States and did all the interviewing. So my background as a journalist and as a TV interviewer are what I'm going to pull into radio.
Do you ever think you would want to go back into television, maybe go the same route that Larry himself has gone with CNN or other, you know?
No, I wouldn't want to do anything that serious. I find that it's like running in mud or cement to me. I don't want to be that ponderous. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's not for me to do. I'm not interested in that. I would like to go back into television, possibly take the best of my radio show and put it on television, or go into some other area where I could do something different. Yeah, television, after all, I'm one of the television babies, you know. I grew up in television, so naturally there's always an interest in it. But I would rather just do the radio show for the next few years and not think about TV, except, you know, I'll pop on Letterman and the other shows when I feel like I want to do something. But I don't want to make it a steady diet. Radio is going to be my diet now.
You've also written some books.
Yeah, I've written 4 books. I had bestsellers down here in the States.
Now, there's soft pretzels with mustard.
Right. Nobody ever sees you eat tuna fish. Revenge is the best exercise, and if God wanted us to travel, ..
Right.
But I now let's talk again. you know what happens with the radio? Yeah, I'll tell you. I always get stuck in this, the writing the books. My sons always tell me, write another book, Dad. I don't enjoy writing books. The way that it comes about is, I just did it again. I get an idea for a book, and I think, geez, you know, wouldn't it be great if someone write a funny book about travel, and people traveling in cars, buses, planes, that could read this book, you know, in hotels, and a funny book. No one's ever written a really funny book about travel. And I get all these ideas, and I tell it to my people, and they say, oh, let's get a meeting with some publishers. We get a meeting, and the man sits there, and the publisher says, oh, that's a great idea. And everyone's saying, it's a great idea, and I'm feeling real good because everyone agrees it's a great idea. They sign contracts. We all sign contracts. We walk out, and everyone says, great idea, and they leave me, and I'm standing there thinking, wait a minute, now I got to do it. I just wanted them to say that's a great idea. I don't want to have to write it. So I just did it again, now I'm sorry. I started saying something. Someone said, oh, that's a great idea. Let's see if anyone's interested. So I hope I don't have to write any more books.
Well, you have successful books out. You're embarking on a new career as a radio talk show host. You've done documentary films. Is there something that you haven't done that you're dying to do?
Not dying to do. I'm very lucky, you know. When I did the Tonight Show, I had $3 in my pocket, so everything in my life is profit. So I'm not dying to do anything. I'm very fortunate in what I've done all these years. You know, I'm not living in the old neighborhood and all that. No one's poor in my family anymore and all that. But what I would like to do is, I've written a few screenplays and haven't been able to sell them yet. That's probably the most arduous chore that you could ever do in show business, is try to sell a screenplay. So I would like to see one of my screenplays sold. I would like to see it sold and get on the screen and be successful. But I'm not dying to do it, but it would be gratifying to me if it happened.
You say when you first started in stand-up, you were waiting for that big break on the Tonight Show. Now, when you first went into television, when you first started doing stand-up, there wasn't the explosion of comedy clubs that are out there right now.
No, not at all.
How do you think it would have changed your career had you come along now? Harder or easier?
I think it would be harder because there's a glut in the marketplace. But if you're different, see, the thing about with me, I was very fortunate in that there hadn't been a new comedian in about 6 years. David Steinberg out of Canada and Robert Klein, I think, were the last two. And they had started about 6 or 8 years before I did.
What year are we talking about, roughly?
Well, in 1970.
Okay.
So I was a new face, first of all, and then I had this different brand of comedy that no one was doing. This observational, where you just pick on anything that's right in front of your eyes, the everyday. Like, Richard Lewis is a good friend of mine, a comedian here, and he said, in a funny way, he said that I had a monopoly on the mundane. I mean, you know, combing the hair, fixing your shoelace. I mean, I can make jokes about all that, which everybody's doing now. In this comedy explosion, that's what they're all doing, this observational stuff. But because I was different, I made it. So I think I probably would have made it now with the glut because I would have been different and I had the tenacity. You know, I had that killer drive from growing up poor, which you really need too.
It sounds like when you describe the type of comedy you do, it almost sounds like it's the originator of what Jerry Seinfeld has made so successful.
Of course, you know, yeah, Gary Shandling and Seinfeld, they all do what I do, you know, but to their credit, they've made a great career out of it. It's wonderful, and I don't begrudge anybody. I think it's great. You know, first time I ever saw Gary Shandling, I went backstage, he freaked out. He said, "I'm your biggest fan." He said, "Do you see any of you in me?" I said, "Gary, I'm looking for some of you in you." I said, "You got my smile, my hands, my everything." So he like got taken aback. I said, "I'm only kidding you." I said, "You know, you're coming to your own. I'm flattered that you emulate me. You know, and I am. I'm flattered all these guys do. I mean, I think it's wonderful. It's very flattering that they do that. A lot of them give me credit for it, which is nice. But there's plenty of room for everybody. I mean, who am I to complain? I'm not walking down the slums of Philadelphia worrying about some guy coming out of an alley with a baseball bat to take my money. So everything is fine."
Who makes you laugh?
I'm easy. I'm too easy. Everyone makes me laugh. I like all brands of humor. Everyone makes me laugh, from Henny Youngman's one-liners, which I heard one the other day,
A new Henny joke?
A new Henny joke. A new Henny joke is that the pioneers only made one mistake. They put the airports too close to the cities. I mean, it's a brilliant joke. It's brilliant, the pioneers. I mean, it's brilliant. I love Henny Youngman, Richie Pryor, Cosby, Seinfeld, all the guys, Robin Williams, whatever, all the different styles. I'm an easy audience. I think all these guys, my favorites are guys I started with, like Richard Lewis and Steve Annisberg, but Stephen Wright. I mean, you can hardly name a guy that I don't really like and admire.
What are the crowds like in Branson?
Well, they're very different. There are a lot of families, and it's a good mixture of families and old people at the same time. A lot of families, because this is a kid's paradise down here. There must be 20 miniature golf courses and 10 bumping cars rides and bungee jumping and boats, and there's a lake and there's fishing. I mean, it goes on forever for children, especially. So the audiences are mixed age, but the one thing they have in common is that they're all, I would say the greater majority, into the 97%, are all very conservative Bible Belt people. You can't cuss. They say cuss. We said curse growing up. You can't cuss. You can't use any cuss words or any inference to anything. I think if you said cleavage and you weren't talking about rocks, they'd probably throw you out of town. But they're the good folks, you know what I mean? They're good people. They're the ones who attend church and respect their neighbors and don't cuss and all that. So that's what you really have here.
Family audiences, you've been around, as you say, since 1970. Do you find it now that there are people in the audience who bring their kids who were fans of yours when you first started?
Well, you know what's amazing is when I have people. I mean, I'm a young guy, but I just started young, and I'm amazed when young people come up to me who are now like, 20, 28, 29 years old, and they say, "Geez, when I was a kid, my mother used to let me stay up to watch you on the Tonight Show. I used to watch you on Mike." And I'm looking at this man standing in front of me. I'm thinking, when you were a kid? And then I realize he's right. I mean, it's 20 years ago, he was a kid. So that astounds me, you know. I've always had a whole, my demographics have always been from little children up to old people, from the day I walked on a stage where they knew who I was. And it's still the same way. I once had five generations come to see me, and it was because the oldest one, who was 85, they asked her what she wanted for her birthday. She knew I was coming in her town. She said, "I want to see David Brennan live on stage." So I had five generations of fans backstage taking pictures with me. It was unbelievable.
Well, that says a lot about your talent, too.
Well, it says that I somehow hit a common denominator without being boring. Usually you hear common denominator and you want to run to the hills. You know what I mean? The minute you hear common denominator, you know, the educational level's lower, the car isn't going to drive as well, you know. So I don't want to just lump myself in with the Yugo and the American school system. But I have somehow hit the... And when I go to colleges, I'm big on college campuses or something. I don't know. I never analyzed it, no more than I would analyze how I walk, because then I would probably stand still the rest of my life.
Having a father as a vaudevillian, he must be pretty proud of your career.
Well, he was. He's passed away, but he was absolutely... I'll never have a bigger fan. He drove me crazy in ways. He taped every show I was on. He videoed on the machines, and he clipped out. I mean, if a newspaper had an article about me, and the clipping service sent him 50 of the 100 or 500 of the same article, syndicated around the country in the newspapers, he would put them all in the scrapbook. I used to say to him, put in one. One's enough. They all say the same thing. No, one at all.
Did you get any stage tips from your dad?
Yeah, he always, he used to say to me, he'd say, you know, get out there and just tell the people the truth, you know. Just tell them the truth.
That was part of an interview with David Brenner. David died recently at his Manhattan home on March 15, 2014, at the age of 78, from cancer. You can hear the full interview with David on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on the celebrity audio files, and you'll find the interview with David and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order, and you can play them right off the page.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program, but we do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day. A charity hockey game in Nassau County, New York, was tied at 3 in the second period. Two players were fighting, and referees tried to stop them. Then the benches cleared. All of a sudden, an all-out war just broke out among the players, said one of the fans. The teams that were playing, the police and fire departments of nearby New York City. The fight and the ensuing cleanup interrupted the game for about 25 minutes. By the end, New York's finest, that would be the police, beat, not literally this time, New York's bravest, the firefighters, 8-5. Now they get to play New York's strongest, that would be the garbage men, and New York's boldest, that would be corrections officers, for the title of New York's rowdiest. Basically, that's how that turned out. And we have a couple of criminals who aren't quite ready for prime time. Criminal number one, Mr. Yaphet Tadesse, was sentenced in federal court in March to a year in prison for filing fraudulent tax returns for certain Walmart employees from fictitious addresses for 2012 and 2013. Among the fake returns that Tadesse apparently failed to double-check was that of supposed Georgia Walmart employee Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General. Nice going, pal. Nice going. And not ready for primetime, criminal number two, Ryan Tremblay, age 29, was charged with trying to rob Bubbles Hair Salon in Annapolis, Maryland, in April. Explained the salon's receptionist. He was like, give me all your money. And I said, not today. Who tries to rob a salon? Tremblay left to the sound of her laughter and was picked up at his mother's house. Yes. I had some thoughts of actually making these guys the idiot of the day, but not quite. They're not ready for prime time, and they're not ready for idiot of the day either. But this next story, yes, boys and girls, it is time for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
A Michigan woman could be heading to jail for allegedly bragging on Facebook about beating a random breathalyzer test. This is very reminiscent to the Stuff File Idiot of the Day story last week. If you don't remember, go back to show number 0244 and listen. And if you didn't listen last week, well, shame on you. You know there could always be a test. Where was I? Oh, yes. 22-year-old Colleen Cudney is not allowed to drink as a condition of her probation for a 2012 drunken driving conviction and was called in for the test after St. Patrick's Day. She passed the test, then boasted on Facebook about her achievement, and I'm doing air quotes here, buzz killer for me. I had a breathalyzer this morning, and I drank yesterday, but I passed, thank God, LOL, she allegedly posted in her status update that eventually got the attention of law enforcement. Cudney was called in for another test, a urine test, which could detect the consumption of alcohol from up to 80 hours previously, but reportedly, she hung up the phone. She's due in court and could face up to 93 days in jail. Now, why? Why would someone who is on probation go online to brag about the fact that they'd beaten their probation restrictions? Well, one reason, and one reason only. She's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0245. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0245. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.